this week on Writers, Inc.
And that's something I think people don't know. I get asked a lot, what's my advice for young writers? And part of my advice is to always have something else you love to do. And if it's a physical thing, so much the better. I still get ideas when I'm cooking, if I'm stuck for something, just something I can do with my hands. If I'm making bread, or if I'm making a dish, or if I'm gardening, or even out walking, some repetitive, gentle motion that kind of stirs the mental pot.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
Ho, ho, ho. I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc., the Christmas episode. This Christmas is honestly bittersweet. Did I tell you that my daughter figured out that I'm Santa?
Yeah.
I don't know if we talked about that on the air.
We did, which is sad.
Yeah, so it's come up a couple of times. Like, you know, like she used to have this book that has Santa's picture on it. And like she would write down what she wants throughout the year in this book. And like she picked it up the other day to write something down. And she's like, I should probably just tell you, right? And that just, it keeps coming up. And it's making me very sad.
So look, lean into it. Say, look, yes, I am Santa, which means I'm very busy on Christmas Eve. Just lean into the whole thing.
I did get extra cookies, which was good, because like she was baking cookies with my wife yesterday. I was like, you know, because I'm Santa, you might as well just hand them directly to me instead of saving and putting them out on the plate.
Exploiting the cookie clause. I like it, JD. I like it.
There was that. We've been gone for like a week and a half. We were up in the mountains and we just came home. We just got our dog back. Like he was at the doggy daycare pet resort place. And like, I think we talked about this on the air too, but we just spent $50,000 just fencing in our property to basically keep the dog in the yard. Mm-hmm. He was home for maybe 5 minutes and he found the one spot where he can actually get out.
Of course.
Yeah. And it's like this weird spot that like we can't really put a fence on, so I've got somebody coming out in a little bit to try and figure out a way to block it. But yeah, like I spotted him on a security camera and like he's just running down the street like I'm free.
Oh no.
So our $50,000 fence is now worthless.
I'm surprised you don't have the one of those collars that is an invisible fence.
We were going to do that, but the thing is, like, there's two little girls that live next door to us that are real good friends with my daughter. And, like, you know, my daughter is next door all the time. The dog is always over there with her. So, like, there's no way to tell the dog the electronic fence is on now, but not now. You know what I mean?
See.
Like, I would have loved to go that route. I mean, and they've got a couple cool ones. There's a portable one you can get where you basically just tell it, like, this is the perimeter. So, like, you set this thing in the middle of your house or whatever, and you can extend that perimeter up to, like, a half mile if you want to around your house, or you can make it as small as like 50 feet, which is all very cool. But
just have to put your neighbor's house in it too.
Yeah. Well, we don't want him going over there when he's not supposed to, because that's another thing. Like he would like just leave the yard, like we let him out the back door, and he would just bolt over to the neighbor's house to go play with their kids.
Oh.
You know, and they're eating dinner or whatever. The kids aren't even home. Like you don't want a random dog just showing up, and he will, you know, completely, he'll walk right into their house like if they open a door. You know, like he's. He is not shy.
Yeah.
No.
Anyway, you guys ready for Christmas?
No.
Mostly.
It doesn't even feel like Christmas to me. Instead of unwrapping gifts, we are just packing everything into crates and boxes.
So. Maybe you should wrap the boxes.
Yeah, we should wrap the boxes.
That'd be hilarious.
To unwrap later.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we don't have a Christmas tree. We don't have any decorations up. We've been playing music, but... it's not quite the same. So every now and then I slip out and go endure like shopping malls and stuff just to get that Christmas spirit. Like,
get a little hit of Christmas spirit.
Yeah.
Your Christmas spirit can be bourbon.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I'm going to be full of the Christmas spirit.
Aww.
Are you guys traveling? You guys, doing anything?
No, my husband wanted to. And I'm like, no. Last minute, he's like, let's travel. And I'm like, let's not. just like to stay here.
Who would do that on purpose?
I know.
Well, we're gonna go see my mom probably the day after Christmas, but that's as much.
Yeah, I get going out to see family, you know, like yeah. We did that for years and years and years, but like to just decide you want to just travel at Christmas,
yeah,
without family as a destination, I don't know that would be. I mean, I have heard like Disney World, like if you go to Disney for like Christmas, it's dead. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a couple of really cool places you can get into, you know, with like no lines and stuff if you're willing to do it on Christmas.
Yeah, it's a good time to go, but because most people don't want to spend their most people think it's going to be super crowded, so they don't want to spend their Christmas, you know, fighting lines and stuff.
Now you've blown the secret. It's just going to be busy from now on.
So my wife and I, our anniversary is January 8th.
Get it right.
I almost said the wrong number. Jay, we were 2006, so this is our 20th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah, you know, she endured me for 20 full years, but we went to Disney World for our honeymoon, so
nice.
It's kind of a nice, yeah. So that's anyway, cute.
Fun fact, January 8th is also Elvis's birthday.
That's right. I knew that. I get that email or that phone call from my friend David every year. Happy Elvis's birthday.
as you should. Yeah. All right. What is in the news?
Well, Elvis was born. No. Kindle's new, quote, Ask This Book uses generative AI to create an in-book chatbot without permission or rights. Amazon has quietly launched Ask This Book, an in-Kindle AI chatbot that lets readers ask questions about a book's plot, characters, and themes without notifying authors or publishers or giving them any way to opt out. Authors and publishers are alarmed because the feature appears to analyze the full text of copyrighted books using generative AI. Amazon has not explained what rights it is relying on, how the AI works, or what safeguards exist. The rollout has renewed calls for legal scrutiny and collective action, with many authors and advocates warning this could violate copyright and undermine hard-won limits on generative AI use in publishing.
Why is it with all this AI stuff, they just kind of throw it out into the world and then try to figure out what's going to go wrong after it's already there?
It's cheaper to do that than to go through the whole process of trying to get permission. It's the whole ask forgiveness instead of permission thing. And they win. They win 100% of the time. They're going to win on this too. So I don't even care.
I can see this taking off. I mean, one of the things that happens with my books, because they're pretty, you know, complicated, there's a lot of twist going on and stuff like that. And people, you know, they take notes as they read through it. And like I see it sometimes in their Goodreads, they, you know, they'll type some of those notes in there. That's one of the reasons why I included evidence boards in some of my books, just to kind of keep the reader on the same page with the police investigation going on.
Yeah.
But there, you know, like there's plot holes that exist in some of my earlier books that, you know, you write something 200 pages later, you forget you wrote it, and then it ends up slipping out through a publication. Like you need to make sure as an author now you weed out every single one of these, because the AI is going to catch it.
Yeah.
You know, so no. every little goof that you make now that, you know, might be forgiven by human memory is no longer, you know, you're not going to get that free pass anymore.
Yeah. You know, I can actually see this being very handy, because occasionally I will put a book down for a while and then come back to it. Maybe I remember everything, maybe I don't. But also if you were reading like a lengthy series, you could ask, you know, for a recap basically of, you know, hey, what happened in the rest of the Jack Reacher series, you know, with this character? Where did this character get introduced? I could see that being very useful, but
yeah, the various writer communities are up in arms about it though, for the reasons. Yeah. We stated, you know, lack of transparency.
There's no guarantee that the AI gets it right either. Yeah. I mean, that's a huge problem, is that AI like just hallucinates things. So like, you know, as an author, that does get a little concerning, where it's like you were saying, JD, you have plot holes or like plot twists or like these things are going on and someone's confused, then the AI answers it wrong. And like that could actually influence the reader's like enjoyment of the book, right? Because then it's going to be like, well, the ending doesn't make any sense now. It does, but the AI could get it wrong. And how are they, I guess, on the back end, like, you know, verifying and double checking, like, you know, what is happening there?
Yeah. I promise you they're not.
I mean, I there's very few things I actually use AI for writer related, but like one of them is I've been taking like the finished book and dropping it in there, specifically looking for plot holes or anything, you know, any threads that I didn't answer and anything weird like that. I just feel authors at this point really need to make sure we button all that kind of stuff up. And, you know, human editors in my world, like I've got a lot of people that read these books before they get out there. They usually get caught, but usually being the key word there. Like I've had stuff slip through four or five different rounds of editing and completely get missed and then get caught at the, you know, the tail end. And AI is capable of catching a lot of these things in advance. And I think that's important because, you know, like if your ending doesn't make sense to an AI, you know, when you're in the draft stage, you know, it's obviously not going to make sense to the same AI that's doing this for the readers at the, you know, the tail end of the stage. So you've got to make sure that all these things are tight.
That's a good point.
I've been using AI in my looping process. So as I, cause I don't, I think I've told you guys about this before, but like I loop back every day to rework what I wrote the day before. So what I do is once I've done that, I drop it into AI and say, hey, help me spot the typos. And then it does that. And then as a bonus, it'll throw in things like, well, you know, you called this character, you know, Bob in chapter 2, and now you're calling him Rick in chapter 5. You know, you may want to look at that. So it's become pretty handy. Let's move on. So next up, writers often overlook interested agents' conference data shows. Early data from a new agent-writer matching program shows writers miss interested agents 66% of the time, often overlooking agents who actually want to meet them. At the TBR Writing and Publishing Conference, 2 out of 3 agents who showed strong interest weren't on writers' original wish lists, suggesting research-based querying may be flawed. The program flips the traditional pitch model by having agents read submissions first and signal interest rather than writers guessing who to query. Organizers say the results could point toward new tools or databases to better connect writers with the right agents and reduce wasted time on both sides.
Yeah. This is such, like, this makes so much sense to me. Querying is such a strange process. Because you're basically just looking people up on the internet you don't know.
Yeah.
And then cold sending them material and then hoping they offer, hoping multiple people offer, and then deciding on people you don't know to get into a business relationship with. And it's just the weirdest process.
It is a weird process. And I think that there is like an inherent logic flaw in how a lot of people are given advice to query. We are usually told to find, you know, if you like a book or, you know, you have a comp for a book, find out who reps that book and query them. But that's actually a little inherently flawed because, you know, I've gotten rejections before of like, I really like this, but it's too similar to a book I already represent.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think I'm a big fan, and I know this is not for the faint of heart because you have to be real, real comfy with rejection, but like just, you know, querying wider than you think, because unless they specifically say like they do not want thrillers, a lot of times agents word their bios in like, you know, something that'll make me miss my subway stop. So if there's like a hint that they might like something that you write, I look for if they have explicit, do not send me this. And if it's on that list, do not send it, obviously. But I mean, I think it's actually a better idea to be a little bolder and braver and query agents that you think might not, like, well, they don't say they want this. Like, send it anyway. You never know. You might be surprised.
My approach is to look for agents who have a bitter hatred of some other agent and then approach them and say, well, that other agent said they really liked this. And they're
do not use this strategy. Kevin. Oh, Kevin. No.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think you need to kind of flip this around backwards and look at the querying process from the agent standpoint.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of agents, you know, almost like investing, like they diversify their portfolio. They don't want all their eggs in one basket. They don't want 10 of this exact same writer because if that genre or whatever goes out of style, now they're screwed. So they purposely tried to diversify. And the other thing is, you know, like there's so many variables involved. Like you have to catch an agent at just the right time. They have to be looking for your book and your voice, and like your query has to resonate with them. And like on a Monday, that may not be true. On a Thursday, it might be, you know, like because you catch them in a better mood than they were the day before. There are like so many moving parts. So I like the fact that in a lot of ways, this puts the onus on the agent to kind of step out there first and say, this is what I like and this is what I want. They're the gatekeeper, you know, so now all of a sudden the gatekeeper is actually, you know, rather than us approaching them blind, you know, they're raising their hand and saying, well, you know, approach me if you're this, this or that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My understanding is this is similar to the way Blacklist works, right? Like you are.
Yeah.
Would you put your manuscript in, which I think makes total sense. You should be able to do that, tag it with some keywords or something so that, you know, the agents are able to kind of comb through and find something they're looking for. Makes a lot more sense than me trying to convince that agent, hey, look, this is right for you.
Yeah, know? This conference was an interesting idea. So these manuscripts went in, a few pages or whatever, from the conference attendees, and the agents just read them blind.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a list of the agents, and the readers say, oh, I want to meet them. And then the agents say, oh, these are the manuscripts I'm interested in. And like those two things did not align.
Isn't that how Pitch Wars used to work when Pitch Wars was around? Wasn't that like...
Yeah, that's exactly how it used to work. Just the agents could come and look at your material. And then if they liked you, they would offer, which makes more sense because we're just here kind of shooting things into the void blindly, hoping we connect with someone. But, you know, people have said always, oh, it's a numbers game, which I think it is because I think... that querying authors are just really bad at knowing who would want to represent them and why.
Yeah. So, well, I guess like going back to what you originally said and, you know, what was in the article about like, you know, I think it's actually very dangerous to have a list of dream agents. And I have heard of querying authors who are like, I will only ever query these 25 agents. And maybe that works, you know, on a long enough timeline, right? Like, anything can possibly work. But I do think that that is sort of like putting an unnecessary limit on, you know, who you're exposing your book to potentially. And like JD said, if you're writing like only one genre and they're heavily invested in that genre, like it's going to be even harder to get them to sign you because, you know, that wow factor has to be like really high for them to take on like yet another author in that genre. So, I think it's kind of tricky to have like that wish list or like, oh, this is my dream agent. Because I think like you never know who your perfect agent could be. And if you're limiting yourself right off the bat, like maybe you don't never come across them because you never considered them.
Yeah. Like do your due diligence, but I think you should query widely. If you get an offer, make sure you research that agent, talk to their clients. But yeah, I think... it's better to play this statistics game, especially given this article that says we have no idea. So,
100%.
Yeah.
All right. Well, last story, Audible partners with TikTok. Audible has announced a partnership with TikTok to help listeners discover top trending books and stories inside the Audible app and web experience. New features will include a dedicated best of book talk destination, collections organized by popular book talk genres, and badges highlighting the books currently trending within the book talk community. This is one of many indicators that the book selling and publishing industry is investing much into bookish TikTok spaces. I hate this.
Why?
I don't want to have anything to do with TikTok. Yeah, I know you guys have better luck with TikTok than I do. I can't stand TikTok, so I don't want to have anything to do with it. But that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean it's not a good source for this. It just means.
Yeah. Well, I think they realize that TikTok is selling books, so they want to be there instead of authors selling directly. You know. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is the equivalent of Barnes & Noble throwing the best of book talk table in the middle of their store, you know, the Audible version of it. I mean, my first thought is I want to reach out to my rep over at Audible to figure out what I could do to put some of my titles on you know, their radar on that side to get them in front of the radar on the TikTok side. There's probably a way to do that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm probably missing out on a bunch of useful things. just because I hate TikTok so much.
I think 2026 is going to be the year of Kevin and TikTok.
Yeah. Kevin and TikTok.
Kevin talk.
Could talk.
Could give you an update at the start of the podcast. Kevin, how is your journey with TikTok going?
Still 6 feet under.
Yeah, I don't know if we wanted to just mention that this just came out today, that Barnes & Noble and Waterstones is rumored to be going up for public trading. And that would
interesting.
Probably be happening summer next year if it happens. So
interesting. Yeah.
Something to keep in
mind. I don't know.
Yeah, I just heard that too. I'm going to dig into it a little bit because, I mean, that essentially means a private equity firm is getting out. Yeah, you know, which could be good or bad. I mean, they're probably cashing out at a decent profit, but luckily there's a lot of financial data that can be reviewed on something like this.
Yeah. Well, and things like this usually indicate that there is some kind of demand in the market as well. So that could be actually good news for us in a kind of sideload way, because if Barnes & Noble's opening up for IPO, it might mean that there is an uptick in demand for books, unless the IPO is centered entirely around their like extraneous inventory.
Yeah.
You know, has nothing to do with books.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound that way.
Yeah, no, I think it potentially could be good. You know, publicly traded companies do sort of, I guess, the good and the bad, they have to answer more responsive to the whims of the public, right? The shareholders. So, yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know if it's good or bad. I think it's very interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah. You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right, JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Jenna Bloom on. Jenna is a New York Times and number one international best-selling author of Those Who Save Us, The Storm Chasers, and The Lost Family. She's back with her latest novel, Murder Your Darlings, a spicy romantic suspense novel due out in January. Here she is, Jenna Bloom.
Well, I'm looking forward to this chat because we've only just met, but I can already tell we've got a lot in common with the whole, both being authors, but also being in the podcast space. And I want to talk a little bit about all that, but welcome to the show, Jenna Bloom.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you were here. I don't want to tell tales out of school or anything. We had a little moment where we were supposed to chat yesterday and you were a little under the weather, and I'm glad to hear you're feeling better.
Thank you. I don't know if anybody else out there gets migraines, but I had a migraine yesterday and Kevin very, very kindly punted our interview to today. And now I'm back and full of energy. It's so weird how that happens.
You got to do. Yeah, I know. That's you're coming back strong. That's why you've got the skill and talent. We like to get to some of the origin story for the people we chat with here. And you've got kind of a history. Let's dive into where did you get started? How did you get started in all this?
I had started writing when I was 4 years old. My dad was a career writer. He was a broadcast journalist and wrote for CBS News. So he wrote for Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather and Harry Reasoner. And if you go back and listen to the broadcast from CBS on Watergate and on Vietnam, that was all my dad's reporting and writing. So I come by it honestly. Although he was a nonfiction writer, obviously, and I am a fiction writer, so I kind of went into my own lane. But my earliest memories were punctuated by the sound of my dad's typewriter. So I guess I never really had a chance to be anything else.
Yeah, that's a great origin. I wish I had something like that kind of in
really, I'm kind of card carrying, right? Like if I'd become a doctor, he probably would have been so disappointed. that makes money. He would have been like, "God, Jen, what are you doing?"
Did he really push you toward this though? Like, was this something he encouraged?
He definitely, both of my parents encouraged me to be a writer. I was very lucky. I know many, many writers whose parents did not encourage them, who did not have the early support. And so they had to fight an extra mile uphill. And both my parents were creatives. My mom was a concert pianist. So it never occurred to me to do anything other than become a creative myself. And neither of them ever said, "Oh, go get a real job," which now I think, well, maybe they should have said, "Go get a real job." But I was so determined from such a young age to succeed in this. It was really the only thing I ever wanted to do.
Yeah.
And so now I have built, luckily, like just so blessedly, a life in which I make my living through writing and writing adjacent things like teaching and speaking and talking about writing. So it really has been a dream come true.
Was there any point at which you thought about doing something else?
Nope.
Nope.
When I was like six, I wanted to be a barber, like that kind of
Okay.
thing. I
Okay.
was for many years a waitress
Yeah.
and a hostess and a prep chef and a sous chef because I was supporting my expensive writing habit. So I
Right.
would restaurant work during the day to keep my mind clear for writing at night. And that was all in my 20s and early 30s. And then I got a degree in creative writing from Boston University, a
Okay.
graduate degree, so then I could teach and have a captive audience. And that suited me very well.
Yeah. A lot of us do that kind of thing, I think. We all kind of take that sort of circuitous route until we can figure out a way to get something that pays us to be writers.
Yeah, and that's not an easy thing. And it definitely is a mercurial thing, like the pay as writers. Sometimes you're really up, sometimes you're really down. I did love restaurant work too, I have to say. So every once in a while, if I'm worried about my writing career, I think, well, I can always go back and wait tables. So I can, work in a
Doesn't it
kitchen.
seem like when you're doing things like that, you kind of come away with like more ideas sometimes? Like I feel like now that I'm full time, sometimes I struggle.
100%. And that's something I think people don't know. I get asked a lot, what's my advice for young writers? And part of my advice is to always have something else you love to do. And if it's a physical thing, so much the better. I still get ideas when I'm cooking, if I'm stuck for something, just something I can do with my hands. If I'm making bread or if I'm making a dish or if I'm gardening or even out walking, some repetitive, gentle motion that kind of stirs the mental pot.
Yeah, what do you think that is? What do you think
No,
that's about?
no.
Yeah.
No, William Styron had such a great essay about this in his the collection is called Havanas and Camelot, but the essay is called Walking with Echina, and it's about how he gets all his ideas walking with his golden retriever on Martha's Vineyard. And there's this whole diatribe right in the middle of the essay about how exercise is very bad for writers, and if you're running, you might give yourself a heart attack, but if you're walking, you'll generate ideas. I think it was just he smoked and drank a lot and didn't like to run. But I do find that it is very generative, that right brain, left brain, gentle activity. And I think it's because you're really detaching from trying to force an idea to happen and giving your body and your mind some space to work it out on their own.
I think it's cool though that you had parents that were sort of, we'll say, in the biz and were encouraging. I did not have that experience. I had, well, they were encouraging, but they didn't quite, no one ever understands it, especially when you're not making money.
It's true. And I think writers are a little bit outliers in terms of what we do. It's hard to explain to people what the sort of crop rotation of writing is like when you're in an ideating stage or a writing stage or a promoting stage. And when you are locked down, sometimes it's all you can think about. So we're only half in the room. I mean, it is really sort of a peculiar and wondrous profession.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful to have other writers to talk to about it always and interested readers.
Yeah. When did you cross the line from want to be a writer to actually being published and paid for your work?
When I was 16,
Okay.
I won the 17 Magazine National Fiction Contest, and I forget how much I was paid, but I remember what I spent it on. It was a lot for being 16 in like 1986. So it was like $2,000 or something, which is like $200,000. It was a lot of money to me.
Might as well be, right?
Might
Yeah.
as well be, exactly. And I remember I went to the mall because I grew up in New Jersey, and I bought Aqua Chuck Taylors. That was like the bomb. I think I bought like several pairs of Chuck Taylors
Yeah.
with my money. And I also got modeling headshots because I decided I was going to be a model at that age. And I probably bought clandestinely a lot of cigarettes with it. So,
Okay. All right.
spent my money on good things. But that was the first professional payment I had as a writer. And then I wrote a lot of short stories over the years. I got paid in contributors' copies, maybe like $100 here and there.
Yeah.
And I crossed into being a novelist, a paid novelist, when I was in my late 20s, early 30s. So bad with math. My late 20s, I think, with my first book. And that was really an achievement.
How did that come about? Because you've been writing short stories and obviously modeling and smoking.
Obviously, I actually didn't quite go anywhere, but the headshots are great. They're like these
Smart.
horrible looking, sultry mall headshots. I should
The
use
glamour shot thing, you know,
I
from
literally have a
the
glamour shot with like my puffy 80s triangle of hair. I mean, they're
Right.
and huge bangs. I should dig those out. They're kind of awesome. But anyway, what was the question? The question is, how did this happen? How did this happen to me? So I was writing short stories, which I still love, by the way. I love the purity of the form of a short story, and I
Yeah.
really started out writing short stories. And it seemed to me such a natural progression to go from writing like poetry and journals to short stories to something longer form. I did write my first book when I was 11 about my social studies teacher on whom I had a crush, and I sent it out to every publisher after Xeroxing it at my dad's office, and I actually got great rejection letters from, places like Random House and so on. But I didn't get paid for that one because it didn't get published. So I returned to writing my short stories. I had that early encouragement from 17. And then when I was in graduate school at Boston University, I wrote a draft of a book called Those Who Save Us. And I started sending it out once I got out of school and like really polished it and took some lumps with it. I submitted it to, I want to say, 43 agents, and the 43rd agent took a chance on it, and she is still my agent to this day. So we've been together like 24 years.
Wow.
That kind of hurled me over the transom.
Wow, yeah, that you found an agent that quick and that young. That's impressive. What was
Well, I did have a rejection agent before my agent. I had sent an early draft of Those Who Save Us out, and I had an agent representing me, and she asked for revisions, as most agents will. And I wrote the revisions, and they were not what she wanted. And so she called me, and she had a voice like one of the Simpson sisters. And she said, "I don't know what to tell you. Good luck, kid. This is never going to sell. It's Holocaust fiction. It's too depressing." And I was like, "It's Holocaust fiction. It's supposed to be depressing. I mean, you can't really make jokes about the Holocaust." She sent it back to me, and I remember going to the post office and walking home with a manuscript cradled in my arms like a baby, like sobbing, and on the streets of Boston with my manuscript. And I called my mom and said, "I got this rejection. The agent dumped me. What should I do?" And she said, "Have you ever considered another profession?" And I said, "No." And I hung
Ouch.
up on her, and I went home and I sent out 10 new query letters that day, and one of them was to my existing agent. So this is my story about whenever you get a rejection, pollinate.
Yeah, I love that. Because it's real easy to be discouraged by this stuff for sure. And get that you get that first rejection and you figure that's it. It's over. Done. So,
I
good
think any writer
advice.
out there, you have to have a thick skin.
Yeah.
When people say, like, what does it take to become a writer? I say talent. I mean, you have to know how to put words together, which comes from reading and imagination and practice, all of those things bundled together.
Yeah.
And you also have to have grit. And if you don't have grit, you are not going to make it, because it requires a lot of determination to be in a field that, as we discussed, a lot of people don't know much about or don't recognize as legitimate work. And then
Yeah.
also in the field, you get a lot of rejection. So you have to really want it, and you have to really love what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the experience like when you, okay, so you've got one book. It's on the shelves and you've got an agent. So book number two, what was different when you came back?
Oh man, book two is hard. I mean, most people have a struggle with the sophomore novel, and I had a special struggle with it because book one, knock on wood, knocking on my head, was really, really successful. And it wasn't successful right out of the gate. The hardcover, for Those Who Save Us, which the elevator pitch for that book is, it's about a German woman who has an affair with an SS officer to protect herself and her little daughter during World War II when she's suspected of being a resistance worker. And then the daughter's quest 50 years later to find out what the mom did, because the mom will never talk about it.
Yeah.
So that book developed a sort of a cult following, and it was in part because it got picked up by Borders and won a couple of prizes, but it was also because I was going to three book clubs a day with that book in person, like really pushing it. And at every book club, I would say, "If you love this book, please give it to one other person." And by God, people actually did. So 2 years after the book came out in paperback, it jumped onto the New York Times list. And my agent, who's French, called me one day and she said, "Jenna, all of my colleagues want to know how you get your book onto the New York Times list 2 years after it came out in paperback. They are calling you Z Biscuit." And I realized that my name had become synonymous in New York publishing with the horse that had come from behind, which I took as a compliment. And it's just because the readers passed the book from hand to hand and gave it great word of mouth. And I think that's how a book should be made, honestly, from reader recommendation. Because that book did well, the second book was sold before it was written, and that was much harder for me. I didn't perform as well under contract. And I often say that, like, with the first book, it was like, giving birth in the shack in the woods and for like 3 years of labor, and nobody's around to hear you screaming, but it's like all in your control. With the second book, I had like a team of expert obstetricians standing around checking their watches, saying, "When's the book coming? How's the book doing? Let's take his heartbeat. How's the book doing?" And I did not do as well with that book, writing it, but I did get it out. It's called The Storm Chasers. It's about boy-girl twins, one of whom is bipolar. That was a topic near and dear to my heart as well, because I have bipolar in my family. And I had a great time out in the world promoting that book. I did a lot of storm chasing, took readers along, and they went back to World War II for the third book. So it's really been quite a zigzag.
So you clearly have a love for history, especially a specific era, right? You
I
do a lot
do.
of.
Yeah, gravitated to World War II. I think because my mom is part German and my dad was Jewish, and I interviewed survivors for the Steven Spielberg Survivors of the Shoah Foundation. And so I think, there's always part of me that had sort of lodged in the Holocaust, and my third book was about the diaspora and how you survive something like that and rebuild and how tremendously difficult that is. But that really is my historical lane. I also have a great fondness for like the prairie and the settling of the American Midwest, because that's also part of my family history. But yeah, those are my two historical pets.
How do you handle research for this sort of thing?
I, really go down the rabbit hole with research, like a lot of writers do. And one of the most popular questions I get asked as a historical novelist is, when do you know it's time to stop researching and start writing a book? But I like to have a really firm groundwork of research underneath me before I start writing. I'm not a Mad Libs author, write the story and fill in the research after, because I feel as though the research and the time period really helps make the person who you're narrating through. So to give you an example, when I was writing my first book, I researched everything I could about the Holocaust, which basically took me 10 years. But I read everything I could get my hands on. I listened to German music. I watched German documentaries and movies from the time period. I dressed like my main character when I was writing, and she works in a baker. So for, 10 years while I was writing that book, I had a great Halloween costume as a German domestic. And I baked everything that appears in that novel, which is not a small feat because, as I said, it's set in a bakery. So I was like baking all the time.
Wow. You may be the first method writer I've ever met.
Yes, I love that term. I think that's so great. And the third novel has a restaurant in it named Masha's. And I created a menu for Masha's. And I also like baked everything and cooked everything that was on that menu, which was the most delightful summer I ever spent. So I really go deep, and I love the sort of tactility of method research. I think it helps you put the reader really squarely in the physical experience of the characters.
That's really interesting. I don't. The things I write about, I definitely would not want to practice in real life, especially some of the more dangerous stuff. But I applaud you. That's a that's a fun way to go about it. Look, can we talk a little bit about your the actual writing process you go through? Like, what are your methods and tricks that you use for keeping a book on track?
Yeah, absolutely. I am a dedicated plotter. I think I might have mentioned that. I'm not a pantser. And when I write a book, I have an outline for it. I have like a one-page synopsis and also a sort of what it's about, thematic mission statement that I hope is never baldly stated in the book, but leeches through on every page. I create an outline, put it on my wall. And when I am in it, I write a scene every day, which translates to a chapter every day in the book. And I actually put it on my calendar so I know what I'm going to write on which day. And I don't allow myself in the first draft to tinker. I just take a run through the whole draft. And I know, I mean, part of the frustration with writing is that a lot of what you're writing is going to be wrong and you're going to have to end up rewriting it. It's a highly inefficient process to be a writer, but that's how I do it. And the thing that takes me a long time is not therefore actually writing the book. What takes me the longest time is coming up with an idea that I love enough to stick with it. And that is just a process of kind of walking around, rolling ideas around in my head and seeing which ones are going to keep rolling around or which ones are going to like disappear through some knothole somewhere.
When you're cooking those meals or taking those walks, that which idea keeps coming back?
That's exactly right. And I mean, you know, writers are such jerks. Like when we are working on a book, maybe I would say I'm at best half there, you know, maybe three quarters there if you're really lucky. But even when I am not ensconced in the actual process of writing, I'm usually thinking about one idea or another. It's just the engine is kind of always humming in the background. When I'm working on a book, it's like super on, and I don't want to be bothered. Like I don't want to be disturbed.
I outliners always impress me. I've tried very hard to be an outliner. I worked with JD Barker on a book, and he's a dedicated outliner. When you say outline, what is it that you specifically do when you outline? Because I think I do it all wrong.
Oh, there's no right or wrong way to do it. Literally no right or wrong way to do any part of the writing process. And if somebody tells you you're doing something wrong, run away from that person as fast as possible. I basically write down, I mean, I handwrite still with like Sharpies or like disposable fountain pens in a journal. And I handwrite a list of scenes. Like I handwrite as many scenes as I know and sort of break down the basic overall shape of the book into as granular scenes as possible. And then I type that up and I put it on the wall. It's basically a laundry list of scenes. And I mean, it's not like a terrible Roman numeral outline like we all had to do in grade school. It's just a list of scenes and it helps keep me on track. And a lot of times in the first draft, there will be question marks in the murky middle that I then, you know, go and just write something, you know, to try and fill those scenes in. And then as I limber up and get into the project, I think, oh, of course, that was what was supposed to be there all along by about like the third or fourth draft.
Do you feel like that happens? Like to me, it seems like just when I don't know what's going to go there, if I concentrate just on building momentum with what I'm writing, suddenly it appears. Sort of a leap in the net appears kind of philosophy of writing, I guess. Is that your kind of your experience as well?
Yeah, I think you have to because nobody knows, like literally nobody knows what the whole book is perfectly right out of the gate. I'm thinking about people who I feel are supremely confident with writing, and even they don't know. I mean, you have to be always a little humbled by your own books, and it is a great metaphor, the leap in the net appears. I always think about the second Indiana Jones movie when he's getting to the Temple of Doom, and they say, make the leap from the lion's head. And he's like, leap from the lion's head. And he leaps out over a chasm, and there's suddenly this bridge you can't see. And I feel like that's kind of what writing is
That's
like.
movie three, by the way. That's
Oh,
Last
it's, oh,
Crusade.
no, you're so right. Sorry.
I'm just throwing it in there because there's going to
Nobody
be
lives in Temple
someone
of
like
Doom.
me listening, shouting
Oh,
at their.
no. Sorry, you guys. I stand corrected. I actually did not like Temple of Doom, but I did love Last Crusade, and I love the first, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, too. So good.
All right. Well, before I turn this into an Indiana Jones podcast, because I
Oh,
will,
go for it. Go for it.
you've got a new book coming out,
I do.
and it's called Murder Your Darlings, which is clearly referencing something we commonly hear as writers, a bit of advice. Let's talk about that book. What's the origin there?
Let's, oh my God, I love Darling so much, I have to say. I had such a kick writing this novel. It was so much fun. And in
It's
that
a
way,
new genre for you. This is something different.
it is. It's a psychological thriller. And I say that to differentiate it from a thriller that is more of a police procedural with like bodies piling up. And it's not a mystery. It's more of sort of a dark thing about what makes people do what they do, which I have arguably been writing all along, but in historical form. This is much more contemporary, and it was a total joy. So, Darlings, you ready for my elevator pitch?
Give it. I'm ready.
All right. So, Darlings is about a mid-career female author named Sam Vetiver, and she's on tour with her fourth book, and she's on contract to write her fifth book, which she despises. She's writing historical fiction, and she's losing a little steam with every book. And she also is a year divorced, and she's kind of at a crossroads in her life where she's like, God, I would just give this all up if I could just find somebody to spend my life with. And so she's just kind of a bit lost at sea. And into her life comes this stratospherically successful and extremely charming male writer named William Corwin. And the two of them develop a rapport and then a romance, and then bodies start to pile up all around them in the literary community. And Sam is forced to question, is it William, and can he be everything he seems because he just seems so great? Or is it one of William's many female stalkers, including a very dangerous and determined stalker called the Rabbit? And Sam gets a third of the story, the Rabbit gets a third of the story, and William also gets a third of the story. And so it is like all dish about all the writer life, like really everything it's like to be a writer. And also sort of ask the question, what would make a woman with an otherwise stable life go down the rabbit hole to pursue somebody she really loves, even though she has all manner of red flags popping up all around her. I'm fascinated by that question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and honestly, I don't know what it is, but I love books and movies and TV shows that feature writers as protagonists and show the behind the scenes and that sort of thing. So that's why I'm very interested in the book.
Thank you. Me too. I'm so glad you said that. What's your favorite? I know I'm not supposed to be asking the questions, but what's your favorite book or movie about writers?
Oh my, don't do that to me.
Sorry.
It's hard to say. Well, you know, there's, I don't know. I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer for what is my favorite, because they kind of keep popping up. And I, in terms of movies, you know, there's the goofy ones that I like, do you remember Funny Farm with Chevy Chase?
Oh my gosh. Yes. I love that when he moves out to the country.
Exactly. I feel like there's a scene in that movie that to me sums up what writing life can be like, where you're all set. You got the perfect desk, the perfect view. You get the laptop fired up and then you type V and you sit there for like days. So that's probably not a very good answer, actually.
Okay, I'm going to rewatch Funny Farm now. That was a great movie.
I love that movie. Yeah, I'm writing a book right now that features a writer protagonist, and so I've kind of been thinking a little bit about this lately. So I'm going to add yours to the research, and that brings me to my next question, by the way, which is, did you use method research in this book?
Yes, I used
did you? Okay.
My whole life, which is what was so great about it. I didn't have to research it because I had already lived it. I've been living it since I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
All I had to do to research this book, instead of, you know, sitting down and opening a vein, as Hemingway said, I just sat down and unpacked my life. And I have to tell you, it was such a joy. I think our life is really weird, and I think it's really wonderful in many ways.
Yeah.
And I snort laughed my way through the entire book, because so much of what we do is just so strange and funny. And I think William, who is a rabid narcissist, is a total hoot. And I think the rabbit also, who's a bookseller stalker, is a total hoot. So I laughed, and I think, like, I hope everybody finds this as funny as I did.
Did you said you dedicated like a third to each of those characters. So did you switch POVs for each character? I'm telling myself, showing that I haven't read the book yet. Sorry about that.
Oh yeah. No. Oh, that's kind of, I love it when you read it. And I have to say that I also, because I to get in the zone by monkey see, monkey do, like I was reading only books about writers while I was writing this book and watching every movie I could find that featured writers. But my whole life, I have always loved books about writers. And I, for some reason, never thought that I was allowed to write about writers. And this is my origin story for this book, that one day I read Jean Hampf Korolitz's The Plot, which is so funny and so smart and so much about writing and so much about publishing. And I thought, well, if Jean can has cheeseburger, why can't I has cheeseburger? So I stalked her. I called her. I got her number from a friend and called her and said, did you get pushback when you switched genres to writing thrillers? And she said, I just write what I write and other people market it and you should write what you write. And I thought, oh, thank God. So I loved it so much. And, you know, Stephen King is one of my favorite writers. He writes about writers all the time. William Styron, Meg Wolitzer. I thought, finally, I get to do this thing too. So I just suddenly had permission and I was like, boing, you know, I felt very buoyant about it. So it was really a joy to write this.
I love it. Yeah. I don't know. What is it? It's insider baseball, basically, right? Like we get to share all the dirt in that.
Hugely. If anybody on listening to a podcast called Writers Inc., if anybody out there is interested in writing, this is the book for you, because I pulled no punches. Like I talked about what the creative process is like, what it's like to be on book tour, like what you eat on book tour, writer ambition, writer competitiveness, publishing contracts, your agent, blah, 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 you know, all of it. Grad school. There are a couple of chapters dedicated to the MFA workshop. Arguably my favorite chapters to write. So well in there.
The most ridiculous time of my life was grad school. I mean, just come on. This is not in reality in any way.
Oh my God. No, it's a great break from your life where you just get to focus on writing all the time. But it also is like this simmering stew pot of, you know, mad resentments and support and friendship and sort of band of brothers effect. But I mean, we were ravaged in grad school. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
We were just like savaged and ravaged by our instructors and the other people. And oh my God, if you could survive it, you can survive being a writer, basically.
Maybe that's what the point of it is. I mean, maybe that's the whole deal, you know? This is preparing you for the gauntlet that you will be running as a professional out in publishing.
That's what they said. They were like, if you can't take this, get out of the kitchen.
Well, yeah. Okay. So that book, so now I have a date of 1 month from now, not 1 year from now.
Yeah, sir. Yeah. You can buy it whenever you want, but it's coming out on January 13th, 2026, which is going to be
Perfect.
such a fun release. I'm so excited for it.
Have you already lined up what you're doing next? You method researching something new?
I am going on tour. So I'm going to be on
Oh, okay.
tour for
Yeah.
like, I don't know, a long time, like
So
3 months.
the sequel will be about an author on tour.
I hope so. I mean, honestly, I would love to keep writing literary thrillers, and the act of writing and writing professionally lends itself so well to many murderous deeds,
Yeah.
honestly. So, I
Especially
mean,
these days.
yep, you've probably heard it all right here.
Yeah, well, a little bit. And I'm listening to Lee Child's book Reacher, and he's talking about publishing in the 90s, and I'm like, "Oh,
Good
I
old
wish I'd be
days.
able to do that." Yeah. All right. Well, okay. So 1 month from now, that means 1/13/26. Can't wait. I'm already eager and excited about it. Thanks so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a delight. And I wish you luck with your book about writers.
Oh yeah, it's going to be a fun one. It's always fun to talk to writers who are writing about writers. I don't, because it is inside baseball, and we spill all the tea, right? So, but I'm kind of curious if you think that readers are interested in writer and stories about writers. Do you think
Yes.
that's a popular thing?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah.
Misery was great. Come on.
I know.
Misery was great. Yeah. No, I do. I think that readers sort of, if you look at any sort of like, quote unquote celebrity industry, right? Like if you're into movies, like you really like the behind the scenes stuff, right? Like with the directors and like the cinematography. And if you're into like sports, you like those, the stories of the athletes and all that. I don't think it's any different for readers. I think that they do. They like kind of, we all like peeking behind the curtain and seeing a glimpse of the wizard and what's really happening there. I think it's and I think readers are more curious too. So I definitely think they like it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed her impersonations. I think that, she definitely could become a voice actor. Like it was very fun to listen to her her interview.
Yeah. She's a method writer. Do you guys consider yourself method writers?
I mean, like I guess I write about stuff that I do at work. So in that
Yeah.
way, yes, but
I've always wanted to do this, by the way. I've always
you
wanted to
know.
like embed myself in something and then, write it from the inside out that way.
Yeah.
But the things I write about, I don't think I would enjoy doing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do because I'm also, as a psychologist, have treated some interesting things. But in terms of serial killing, not so much. I've not method acted that very much.
Not that I'll admit to.
Right. I'm kind of like a very like kinesthetic person, so I guess like in a way I kind of do like I have to sort of be able to like feel like I have some sort of understanding of like what's going on. Like I can't just like make something up and like not kind of have a feel for it. I mean, even to the point where I was writing a short story like a couple years ago, and my best friend, was like, she was like the right like weight and height, and I was like, can I try to drag you across the room just to kind of feel like how awkward it would feel, because it wasn't just the act of dragging, like I kind it was kind of like I needed like a humorous slant on it, and so I kind of needed to feel like how would it feel awkward, like what would that feel like. Luckily she's just as up for chaos and mischief as I am, and so she was like, sure.
Well, a lot of people don't realize, but like I've tried that before too, like actually carrying somebody on my shoulder. Like, how far can you actually get carrying that, more or less dead weight? Because they do it on TV, they do it in books, they do it in movies. You try to do it in real life, you're lucky if you get across the room. There's a famous story with Stephen King too, when he was writing Gerald's Game, I think it is, where the wife gets handcuffed to the bed and her husband dies. So he handcuffed his son Joe to a bed and told him, okay, I need you to flip over the back, get behind the headboard, and see if you can push this bed across the room. And I guess his wife walked in and stopped the whole thing before he, you know, flipped over and broke his wrist or whatever would have probably happened. But you know, you got to be authentic to some of these things. The closest I think I've ever gotten to it is I used to own one of those. I bought it in an art studio. It's basically like a human form. And like I would use that when describing like fight scenes and stuff like that. Like I could, you know, kind of move it around. So I had the elbow in the right place and stuff like that. That helped me to visualize things. The last time I've done it, and this doesn't really count, but like when I wrote The Writer with Patterson, our lead detective drank grasshoppers through the whole book. So I actually got hooked on grasshoppers in real life.
Have you ever had that drink?
Jenna,
it's a drink, Jenna. It's a drink.
It's a drink.
It's like alcohol.
It tastes like Andy's candies, if you've ever had those. But it's like, it's almost like a dessert drink.
What is it? It's like something... Does it have like
it's creme de mint?
Yeah.
Don't let them fool you, Jenna. It's pureed grasshoppers. They throw a handful into a blender.
Yum. Yeah.
Order it at your next outing. You'll be very happy.
Yeah.
I did go through a couple of, well, I was a private investigator earlier in my life, and I did a little, they did like a little SWAT training thing at the academy I went to. And so we had to get, you know, tear gassed and things like that. So I've done things like that. And then I did like a writer's police academy thing where you get to kind of do some of that stuff. So I've done some of that kind of thing sort of in the name of learning, getting the experience. And so I can write about it, but yeah, I don't do, I'm not volunteering for a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's a good, the FBI is actually very good about helping writers out.
Yeah.
They will let you into Quantico. There's training programs. They've got the FBI's something academy that you can join. Because they want you to get all the information right too. And they're very transparent. Out of all the alphabet agencies, they're probably the best.
Yeah.
So, so she was saying that her second novel experience was kind of brutal. So what do you guys think is harder, the first book or the second book or subsequent books?
For me, it was the first one. You know, only because I'd been working so long as a book doctor and a ghostwriter, you know, like that was the first time I had to actually step out and put my own name on something. But I, you know, like once I got on that roller coaster, I was fine. So I didn't have that sophomore thing.
I don't know. They're all hard.
Well, they are all hard. I think the biggest difference for most people is that, you know, like the story goes, right? You have 10 years to write your first novel and then 1 year to write the second. And so it kind of makes sense. Like, that's very similar, I think, to what you were just saying, JD. Like, anytime you have to like shift from like your comfort zone into a non-comfort zone, like that's always, I think, going to be difficult to do. Like, I imagine it's not easy for like an established author to shift genres either. Like, cause now you're working with like new editors and new readers and like new, everything gets new. So I think anytime you start, you go from like, oh, I can wrap my arms around this and I get it to like, oh my God, what's happening? That's always going to be a struggle.
Well, you know, honestly, like the trickiest thing that happens is like with that first book, you're basically focused just on the writing. You just knock out the book. When your second book is coming out, you're dealing with marketing for the first book. You're dealing with marketing and all this other stuff for the second book. And a lot more business kind of creeps into your life. And you've got to figure out how to juggle that with, you know, the 26 hours in a day that we all have. And that gets rough.
Yeah. When she was talking about all those book clubs she went to, I was like, holy cow.
I know.
Or, you know, going out on a book tour, you know, all of a sudden you're away from home for 20 weeks or something silly, you know, trying to write in hotel rooms.
Yeah. I was like, I need to move to New York. So there are more book clubs or I don't know, Toronto in my case, maybe.
So I just listened to Lee Child's Reacher and it's kind of a collection of forwards that he wrote for like some special releases of his books. Yeah. And he talks about this kind of thing. Like, and I like the way he put it. And I agree with him that, you know, when he started out and he was doing the grueling book tours, it was, I'm doing this now so I don't have to do it later. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the right approach. Cause you know, you're going to burn out one way or the other. So, you know, burn brightest in the beginning. So
burn out right away. That's what Kevin is saying.
That's the way I did it.
Oh, jeez. All right. JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Mark Gottlieb coming on. Mark's a senior VP and literary agent with Trident Media Group in New York, which is one of the largest literary firms out there. His name regularly appears in Publishers Marketplace with some of the most lucrative deals. He's going to give us some insight into what he sees happening in the publishing world and what we can expect in 2026. So, Mark Gottlieb.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah. Happy everything.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.